Welcome to the Teach the Geek podcast, where engineer and author Neil Thompson talks with STEM professionals about public speaking, a struggle for many of us. Whether you're a novice public speaker or a proficient one, you can always pick up tips on how to improve. Here's your host, Neil Thompson.
Welcome to another edition of Teach the Geek Interviews. My name is Neil Thompson. I am the founder of Teach the Geek. I work with technical professionals so they can present more effectively, especially in front of non-technical audiences. You can learn more about that at teachthegeek.com. Again, that's teachthegeek.com. Today, my guest is Anna Kraft. She is the founder and CEO of Xena Workwear, manufacturing safety boots for women. I never thought that women needed, or at least had this issue with safety boots, but I just figured as long as the boots were small enough for a woman's foot, it'd be good enough. But apparently there's an issue. But and Anna's company is addressing that issue. So I'm really looking forward to learning more about the genesis of Xena Workwear. And of course, we will get into some public speaking stuff as well. So welcome to Teach the Geek Interviews, Anna.
Thanks so much for having me today, Neil.
From the bit of research I did on you, I saw that you studied international project engineering. I've never heard of that in my life. So I'm really curious to learn more about what that is and what made you interested in studying it.
Yeah, every time I share about my program, people say they've never, ever heard about it. It's a small program that I studied in Southern Germany. It was developed specifically for the automotive industry in Southern Germany. Over 50% were engineering subjects, and there was a huge focus on project management, intercultural competencies, learning different languages, basically running a project, being surrounded by specialists who are really good in their area of expertise. But I'm not a specialist in, for example, in electrical engineering or thermal and fluid dynamics or material science. I know enough about it and to be able to run projects. And that program really was the perfect opportunity for me, because I could not decide to study only Spanish or only physics. So turned out to be great and really helped me on my journey to go into engineering and starting a company.
Wow. You know, when I was in school, I had no clue what project management was. When I started working, I had no clue what project management was. Maybe even 10 years into working, I still really didn't know about it. It was actually a colleague of mine that wanted to take a class at one of the local colleges here in San Diego where we live. And that's where I really learned more about project management. It certainly wasn't in school. So the fact that you learned about that so early on, that you were definitely at an advantage to people like myself who had to learn about it much later. Because as I'm sure you know, once you start working at these companies, that's a lot of times that's what you're doing, is working on projects. So if you know all the lingo and just know all, you know, how projects work, from your school days, you're definitely at an advantage to people like me that have to learn about it, you know, years later after leaving school. So, wow, that's a great program.
Yeah. Yeah. It was awesome. Highly recommended. Reutlingen University. Check it out.
So once you finished university, what type of work did you end up doing?
So during my program, because it was international, we all had to go abroad for an internship semester. And I always wanted to go to some exotic country in South America or Asia. But then after applying at so many different companies, I got an offer in a small town called Waukesha, Wisconsin. I'm like, where the hell is Waukesha? So ended up in the U.S. for my internship and met my husband here. After a lot of back and forth traveling between the two countries, I decided to move here when we got married. My husband speaks three languages, but German is unfortunately not one of them. So I found this perfect job here working for a project management consulting company, working on massive multi-million dollar manufacturing and construction projects where I could utilize my skill set. Really, really enjoyed it. But that was the issue when I ran into the safety shoe problem.
Okay. You know, fun fact, I took a semester of German when I was in high school. And I remember nothing. Although I remember getting a good grade in it, though. So apparently I was good enough to do well in the class. But all I remember from back then is, I think, Guten Tag and Dankeschön. That's it. That's all I got.
Awesome. We will test your German today.
Oh, the hell we will. I remember I did German. I think I did a semester of Latin. I did all these weird classes when I was in school.
Yeah, Latin. Did that for 7 years. Once you suffer through Latin, any Romantic language is easy. I studied Spanish as well, so after Latin, Spanish was super easy. But I don't remember much of Latin. I wouldn't be able to translate anything today, probably.
Yeah, I guess I was good enough to do well in the courses because I actually took Spanish too for a semester. But not that nice, Anna. I can't speak Spanish. I can't speak Latin. I can't speak German. I can't speak French. I did French too. Like, the only thing I got is English. This is all I got.
It's hidden somewhere. You just have to go to the country and like be completely immersed. It will come back.
Yeah, you know, it's funny you mentioned that because that's actually one of my biggest fears is being dropped off in the middle of a country and I don't know the language and I have to try to figure out how to survive. It's a huge fear of mine. It's a block that I really need to get past because even all of the traveling that I've done, I've only gone to countries where they speak English.
Oh, you know, but it's fun. Like I love, like when we travel, I love to book a flight to a country or a city. I know where I'm flying into and the city I'm flying out to and everything in between is a mystery. So you just need a lonely planet and then you just figure things out. I think it's good to get outside your comfort zone. So you should put it on your bucket list.
Yeah, that's definitely something to do or something to look into at least. So, you know, I mentioned in the intro that you started a company to develop safety boots for women. And I actually was quite serious. I said in a joking manner where I didn't even realize that women would have an issue with safety boots. I just assumed that as long as the it was small enough and their foot could fit in it, that would be good enough. But apparently that, at least maybe I'm assuming wrong, that's not the case. So what is the issue that women have with the safety boots that are currently out there?
Yeah, I basically working this, like my perfect job, constantly transitioning between the office and the manufacturing floor, I discovered that my safety shoes were incredibly uncomfortable. I had multiple pairs under my desk, so I would wear dress professionally in the meetings. And then as soon as the meetings wrapped up, one of the guys would typically say, all right, everyone go out on the shop floor. I had to hold up the whole room and tell everyone, wait, guys, I have to run back to my desk and put on my safety boots. Had multiple pairs under my desk and none of them fit. They were all incredibly uncomfortable. Often felt like a safety hazard walking in them. Looked hideous. So that's when I started doing a bit more research about safety shoes and figured out that most manufacturers apply the shrink it and pink it concept where they take a men's product, make it smaller and make it pink or purple and label it as women's or unisex. Every time you see a unisex shoe, it's probably a men's shoe that is just smaller. And I thought that this problem needed to be fixed. I waited a few years, complained about it, thought somebody else will figure it out. And when nobody did, I decided to tackle this myself and design the first kind of professional safety shoe that is built around a woman's foot and allows women to dress professionally in the meeting and also be safe out on the shop floor.
Oh, okay. So I guess the difference between, I mean, you mentioned that the boots that you had to wear before, they were uncomfortable for your foot. Were they uncomfortable for your foot because you have a female foot or do you just have a
yeah.
Okay.
So men and women have differently shaped feet. Women's feet tend to be wider around the ball of the foot and narrower in the heel area. We have lower ankles. There's a whole graphic I should share. We have higher arches. So there are a lot of things. It's not just proportionally shrinking the shoe that allows women to get a good fit. It has different proportions. And in order to be comfortable and safe, we need PPE, personal protective equipment that fits well. Safety shoes is one of the issues. There we can talk about safety vests that have similar issues. Like just making a smaller safety vest is not the solution. So there's And I see all these problems being fixed right now by different people across the industry. We focus on safety shoes and there's so much more to be done.
Oh, okay. Oh, I had no clue that women had different shaped feet and different arches and different.
Yeah. Wow. And even hands, like smaller gloves are not the solution. Like with hands, there are a ton of differences. We're working on a report with different safety professionals across the country. We're pulling data, anthropometric data from military and firefighter reports that were collected like in the 70s. Like the data is older, but that's something we can work with and basically comparing different body parts and educating safety professionals, like in many cases, safety managers, they have so much to do during the day. Like they have to make sure they procure the well-fitting PPE, but many of them don't even know that, okay, just smaller size is not the solution. So we're just trying to share more about the issue and provide solutions.
Are there any PPE that men and women can both use that fits both?
Not really. Right now, that's the solution. Right now, that's the reality. But I think over time, we'll have more products that are specifically designed for men and women.
Okay. So you started this company, Zena Footwear, Zena Workwear. You've been around for some time. What was the most surprising thing that you found from founding a company?
When I started the company, I had the illusion that I would have more free time and freedom, but I do have more freedom, for example, to work remotely from Germany where my family is located, but I don't necessarily have more free time. It's just once you start your own company, you feel this incredible commitment to move things forward, especially with a small team. I think, but it's rewarding. I can't complain. I love the journey. I get to learn so much along the way. There's something new you have to figure out on a weekly, monthly basis. Like you get to try so many different solutions. If it doesn't work, you get to adjust. So it's been an incredible learning opportunity for me.
So now that you're the head of a company, you have to be the leader of people. When it comes to leading people, do you think that you should have a leadership style or should you tailor your leadership style to the people that you're leading?
That's a tricky one. So my idea of running a company, I try to learn as much as possible from different founders and leaders in the industry, but my perfect example is Yvan Chouinard, the founder of Patagonia. He hires people who are self-starters and who truly believe in the mission and vision of the company and who don't need to be micromanaged. Like, I hate micromanaging people. I set high standards. My job is to provide the direction for the company and where we're going. But I love to work with people who really want to have an impact, for women, like whatever, like professional development. I want to work with people who believe in the mission of the company and can execute by themselves. So, and that it's a tricky part to hire the right people. That's something I'm still figuring out. But, and of course, you have to understand what people value. Like you have to, everyone has a different communication style. Everyone is incentivized in different ways. So I try to understand what incentivizes the people who work for us and make sure we provide the right opportunity for them.
It's, you know, your answer spurred on another question about leading people and just companies in general. For the longest while, I've heard about hiring for cultural fit. And when I hear that, at least based on your answer, it sounds like you, as you mentioned, you want to hire people that are self-starters who don't need to be micromanaged. So those are people that would fit within the culture of the company. But then maybe a couple of years ago, I heard that cultural fit is out and cultural ad is in. And they say that cultural ad is better because cultural fit would assume that the people are very similar. You know, mentioned being micromanaged and being self-starters. But if you really want the best company, you want people who fall outside perhaps what you would consider, you know, your typical worker, because they will bring different ideas or even better ideas to the company as well. What's your views on this delineation between cultural fit and cultural ad?
Yeah, I've never heard the term cultural ad, so this is really interesting, but I think I know what you're talking about. So I think many people make the mistake that they try to hire like-minded people who think the exact same way. I really try to hire for my weaknesses. So most of the people who work for us, we have completely different opinions on different things of life. But one thing we all agree on is that we want to make an impact for women in STEM in the trades. And they all, like everyone is driven in different ways. And I would say, yeah, it's important to bring in people with different perspectives. Because when you hire different people, you will get more cognitive diversity and like we'll be able to attack problems from different angles and we'll come up with better solutions. So
I think it's smart to hire for those weaknesses. So then you basically have everything covered. I guess one of the things when I think about is hiring for weaknesses is there ever an instance where they could tell you something, but because it's a weakness of yours, you may not know the answer. So you're not able to really guide them all that well into what they should be doing. And not only that, they could very well be telling you something that could be detrimental, but because it's your weakness, you don't know that. And then they do something and then it doesn't work out. And you're looking at them as, why did we do that? And it's like, well, I didn't know.
Yeah. I think it's, you have to allow your people to take risks. Like there's, especially in marketing, like we try to be very open-minded, finding new ways to reach our customers. So we experiment in different ways. And in many cases, things fail. They don't work out as we hoped they would. In the beginning, I remember every one of us would say, like, oh my God, this thing will be a game changer. I'm 100% convinced this is the next thing that will work out. And I think we all got burned so many times that we're like, okay, let's not say it will be the game changer, but let's give it a shot. And we don't, if somebody throws out an idea and we say like, that's the bet for fall or Q4 or Q1, whatever that may be. If it works out, great. If it doesn't work out, we don't blame people for bringing up this idea that failed, because if you punish people for failure, like they will shut down and will stop coming up with creative solutions.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right about that one. And you know, when you were talking, marketing is exactly what I was thinking about when it comes to, you know, because it's true. It's a lot of trial and error, a lot of testing when it comes to marketing. And you might think, well, this is working really well and this over here, so maybe it could work well for us too. So let's give it a shot. And you think, yeah, great. And then you put some money into it and it doesn't work out. And then not only that, then you have to figure out, well, how long should we try something before we say this isn't working? Let's do something else. Because I even know for my own business, Teach the Geek, and whenever I've asked for or gotten marketing help, I'm an impatient person by nature. So if something doesn't work within, you know, a week or two, I'm thinking, okay, this ain't working. I got to do something else. But it's like, no, you got to give it time. But it's like, how much time? Like, how long are we doing? Like, a month, 2 months, 3 months? Like this isn't working for a couple months. Like, I'm supposed to keep putting money into this? Yes. Keep going. It's like, no, not keep going. There is my money. What am I supposed to do with this? But yeah, you're absolutely right about it. But yeah, you got to be able to take risks.
I'm with you on the impatient part. I'm like, okay, it didn't work. I want to see quick results, and sometimes I have to force myself, like, okay, let's give it 2 more months, and then, well, we'll reevaluate, but I'm impatient as well.
Yeah. You know, I don't know, when I first started this podcast, it was about talking to people like myself that have these technical backgrounds about, you know, presenting in front of people, because it wasn't something that I was always great at. It's still a work in progress, but especially when I first started, I was terrible. I mean, I had to give presentations in front of management on a monthly basis, and I would wet the bed on a repeated basis, at least for the first few times. You thought I would have learned after the first or second time, but I was stubborn. Eventually my project got canceled, and I had to, then that was the wake up call I needed to think, maybe this is something I need to get better at, just communicating in front of, especially these, you know, decision makers who tend to be non-technical. When did you see the benefit of I guess being effective as a presenter?
I think in the beginning when I started working, I kind of was thrown into really cold water, which was helpful. I had to quickly learn to lead project planning sessions for multi-million dollar projects with a team between like of 10 to 20 engineers. I was typically the youngest person in the room, the only woman in the room, and I had to get these engineers together and like come up with a project plan. Yeah, I think I had to learn quickly, but there's a huge benefit to be able to be confident in the room. You just need to learn the process. It helps, really helps to be prepared before every meeting or speaking event that you have. So I felt always comfortable in a meeting room presenting in front of people or guiding people through a planning process. But then once I started the company and had my first pitch events where I had to pitch investors for funding, it was again well, typically walking into a room filled with men. Okay, I'm trying to fix this issue in STEM and the trades, and now I'm discovering this next issue that we don't have enough women in the investment world. But I think the more you do it, the more confident you become. And yeah, preparation is key. You have to get outside the
Wow. So yeah, you definitely have some issues there, Ada. You were the only woman, you're the youngest person, and you got these boots that don't fit properly, man. That's just a whole bunch of problems that you're up against. Kudos for you for pushing through them, for sure. You know, it's you now what you said really brought up another question, is the idea of seeking investment for Xena Workwear. You know, oftentimes, I mean, I've interviewed a number of people at this point, and the point that women are underrepresented in the STEM fields is one that some have brought up even during our conversations. And so you're going to an investor and asking them for, you know, for this investment. And if they ever were to say, well, there's not a whole lot of women in the trades anyway, so is this a worthy investment to make? I mean, how big of a pie, or how big of a, like, how big of an impact can we possibly have, given that there's so few people that could potentially be benefit from a different safety work? I mean, what would your answer be to that?
Yeah, of course, I had the data in my deck. Like, it's a over $13 billion market opportunity. You have to, we pulled data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. So, and you have to show, like, the numbers are growing. They're about 30% of women in engineering and manufacturing. We can do much better in construction, professional construction job roles. We have about 10% of women. We're talking about skilled trades. They're 2 to 3%, and that number can be improved. So you have to present the data and the opportunity. And I heard the word no so many times, because most men did not even get the point of the product. And those people who worked in manufacturing or construction, they said, okay, we didn't have a ton of women, so how does it make sense? But 2 months in, we found the perfect investor and have raised another round of funding this year. So it's been a good journey. People get it. We have multiple customers who reached out to me and said, I always wanted to start this company, and since you figured it out, I want to invest in you. So it's been really awesome.
So eventually you came, at least you came across investors that were enthralled or convinced by the message that you gave, or by the presentation that you gave on the importance of what you're working on. Do you have a process for putting your presentations together? And if so, what is it?
As you mentioned, it's work in progress. So it really depends on the audience. If it's a pitch, and even depending on who I'm pitching, I adjust my deck. Some people are impatient, and like some people tell me, okay, this type of investor, they want to see numbers on slide 2. You don't need to talk about all the fluffy stuff like your vision and mission. They don't care about it. So I adjust my presentations based on the target audience. And then same thing applies to my presentations when I'm talking to an audience of entrepreneurs. It's talking about the journey of launching Xena and how to start a company. If I'm talking to safety professionals, I focus more on the more technical parts of safety shoes and differences like anthropometric data and PPE, the importance of women's PPE. So I adjust it every time. But I'm also, I would love to hear how, like, if you have any suggestions for how you create your decks, if you have a process.
I start off with what the call to action is. So what do I want people to take away from the presentation when they leave? And then I essentially work backwards from that. What kind of points do I need to make that funnel into that call to action? So then what ends up happening is you don't have a whole lot in the presentation that's superfluous. That's just fluff that you don't really need, because everything you say is funneling to that, whatever that call to action is, which I would assume with what you do, especially with a pitch, for instance, would be give me money. So what I gotta say that eventually gets to that call to action. That's typically what I do. I start with the end in mind, and then I work backwards.
I love that. Yeah, I think that's a really smart way to think about it.
Well, thank you. And even if you disagree, thanks for not disagreeing with me on camera.
I don't. I'm still figuring things out. I want to streamline my presentations a bit more.
Do you ever get nervous before giving a presentation? And if so, how do you deal with your nerves?
I do. The last time I was nervous was speaking in front of 400 people. And 400 people does not sound like a lot on paper, but once you walk into the room, you're like, oh my God, this is a big room. Like, there are a ton of people here. So I try to tell myself, like, of course I get nervous, but then I try to tell myself, you've practiced this enough. You know what you're talking about. People are here because they find value in the topic. So yeah, I'm looking for tips. Like, what do you suggest? To how do you handle with stress?
Well, the first thing I would say is, when it comes to nerves, they're normal to have. So if the idea is to get rid of them, don't, because what it means to me is that you actually care about the outcome of what you're going to say in front of these people. That's why you're feeling the way you do. You actually care about, you know, what they actually take in, especially if you're giving a pitch. You definitely care because you definitely want that investment. So that's the first thing I'd say. And then secondly, what I like to do, and I, you know, whenever I ask this question, I always get these interesting answers. Actually, I got an interesting one really recently, and this is something I might even try out myself. So the guest that I had said that what she does is she wiggles her toes. She says that by, she says by wiggling her toes, it takes her mind off of the fact that she's nervous. So I thought that's pretty interesting. And then I had another guest who said before they go on stage, they do a lot of, well, not a lot, but they do, I guess, physical movements. So they might do some knee bends. They might do some, you know, some knee tucks, just some physical activity, light physical activity to dissipate that nervous energy. So those are a couple of things that former guests have said. And I've actually tried the physical activity one. And that one seems to work really well. I'm really interested to try the wiggling toes one, though.
I like that.
Yeah.
We'll test it out.
Yeah, we'll see. Yeah, definitely. So when it comes to giving presentations, what would be your number one tip for anyone who is watching or listening to our conversation on how they can become more effective at public speaking?
I think this is a very known thing, but I still see this. Like, don't have too much copy on your slides. Like, some people just write down everything they're saying on their slides to make it so overwhelming. I try to keep my slides clean. In most cases, it's just a picture, nothing else. I think, yeah, you don't need to, like, make it too overwhelming and write down every single thing you want to say.
Oh, I agree with you 100% on it. And I am a firm believer in minimizing the amount of text you have on a slide, because, well, it does two things, both one for the audience and then also for the presenter. For the audience, it eliminates the ability for them to read the slide. So now they either have to listen or ignore you. And hopefully you're engaging enough that they listen. And then for the presenter, it eliminates the crutch of being able to read the slides. So now they really have to know their material really well. And oftentimes by reading the slides, you're not looking at the audience. You're looking at the slides, or you're looking at your screen to be able to read them. And by doing that, it's really difficult to engage people because you're not looking at them. And then when you don't look at them, then it's less likely that they listen. Because oftentimes when you look up, you'll see people on their phones. You'll see people looking out in the space. You'll see people falling asleep. And it's because you weren't looking at them when you were giving a presentation. And why would they? I mean, if you were just talking to somebody, just generally, just, you know, having a regular conversation off the stage, and you weren't looking at the person, are you more likely to listen to them? And they're not looking at you. I mean, y'all looking in different places. I mean, how much are you actually going to take in what they're saying? But for some reason, when we get up on the stage, we think, let's just look at the screen. People are going to listen anyway. It's like, no, they won't.
I agree.
Yeah. Excellent. So this has been a great conversation. Thank you for being a guest. How can people get in touch with you, Anna?
Yeah, I would love to connect on LinkedIn. My name on LinkedIn is my full name is Anastasia Kraft, Kraft, K-R-A-F-T. Or find us at Zena Follow us at zinaworkwear.com on Instagram, LinkedIn. Zina spelled X-E-N-A, Zina Workwear. Yeah, would love to connect on social media channels. LinkedIn is my favorite platform. Or shoot me an email at anna@zinaworkwear.com.
Excellent. Well, everyone, that marks the end of another edition of Teach the Geek Interviews. My name is Neil Thompson, founder of Teach the Geek. You can learn more about it at teachthegeek.com. Again, that's teachthegeek.com. Until next time, take care and stay safe. Thanks, Anna.
Thank you so much.
Well, everyone, that marks another episode in the can. I hope you enjoyed it. If you like these episodes and want to support Teach the Geek, please subscribe, share, and like on any of your favorite podcast platforms, or on all of them. Also, if you prefer to watch the episodes, head on over to the YouTube channel at youtube.teachthegeek.com. Until next time.